From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2016, where a citizen-led campaign succeeded in making Maine the first state to adopt ranked choice voting for state and congressional elections. If you're not familiar with the concept, ranked choice voting allows voters to rank candidates in order of their preference, marking their first choice for office, second choice, and so on. If one candidate gathers a majority of the first place votes, he or she wins. But if not, a series of instant runoffs goes into effect, where the candidate with the fewest votes is eliminated and the second choice selections are added to candidates' tallies. The process continues until one candidate earns more than 50% of the votes. Maine's governor and legislature opposed this process, citing concerns about it possibly violating the state constitution. They voted to delay ranked choice voting until the year 2022, but the courts pushed back, and ranked choice voting was in place for this year's primaries in Maine, so voters could test it out. They did, and they voted to keep it. Ranked choice voting has long been heralded by some political scientists who say it could help blunt the effects of hyper-partisanship, and data shows that in the places where it has been adopted, it has probably increased voter turnout at least some. Cities like Santa Fe, San Francisco, and Minneapolis used ranked choice voting, and it has been a mainstay in Australia for a century, among some other places. So will we ever see it in New York State? My guests this hour discuss that question, as well as the mechanics of ranked choice voting, and they're going to answer your questions about how it could change elections and the political process. I'd like to welcome in studio Seth O'Brien. He's a math teacher at the Harley School and the director of the Commons there. Seth, you have taught ranked choice voting a little bit in class too, right?
Yep. Teach like a variety of voting methods and have the students try and figure out what might be the best voting method.
I'm very curious to hear what they say. Thanks for coming back on the program. Tim Nealon is here, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. He was our second choice to be here, but it turns out you ended up making the cut. You see what I did there?
Hey, I like that.
Thank you. Good. Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
Jesse Lenny, somehow he was first on some ballots, last on many others, but he's back. I'm, again, mostly kidding. Jesse is Western Region Political Director for the New York Working Families Party. Nice to see you back here, Jesse. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Does Working Families want this? Do you want this, Jesse?
The party actually doesn't have a position on it. I mean, I think if you asked, if you surveyed all of us, this would probably be one of the better ones. There are other models, but... we sort of, as we're expanding into other states, we're sort of just picking up whatever the rule of play is for the area and trying the best we can to get progressives elected. So we haven't really put a lot of thought into what our agenda is on this. And we have a full slate of election reforms in New York State, including same-day registration, public financing, automatic registration, things like that. But we haven't really advocated in particular for one of these models.
Okay. All right. Well, listeners, if you've got questions or comments on ranked choice voting, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections at WXXI.org. Seth, you're a teacher. You work with students as they try to understand this. You're a parent. First of all, just about every family has, if you've got kids, you've probably done ranked choice voting when you say, all right, we've got three possible options to spend a week this summer. We're going to go camping, or we're going to go to your aunt's house, or we're going to go to California. Rank them. That's ranked choice voting if you do it that way, if you actually wait there.
So, absolutely.
And, or if you're voting for American League MVP, mm-hmm. you got to rank the choices. We use ranked choice voting, just not in politics in this country, right?
Well, yeah. Well, mostly not in politics. I am excited about San Francisco and Oakland and Minneapolis and some places that do use ranked choice voting, because this is definitely a potential game changer in terms of the nature of politics and access to opportunities. I'm sort of jumping out of order here, but listening to your example, one of the critiques of ranked choice voting, where you're saying at the maybe you are allowed to vote your top three preferences. So maybe in the Democratic primary, I could have candidate A, B, C, and D. A, my top choice, B, my second choice, D, my third choice. One of the critiques, odd critique, is that it's complicated. I can't just check off one person and that's my pick. But we use ranking preferences all the time in our life. And I think more often than not, we are saying, okay, this is my top preference. And if we're not going to have the spaghetti and meatballs for dinner, but we can have the chicken barbecue, that's cool. So that's my second preference, but I definitely don't want the fish. So I'm not going into the election thinking, okay, I know spaghetti and meatballs probably won't win, but that's my top choice. So do I go with my top choice or the one that's going to have the most impact in the election at all in itself? So that think figuring out what to vote for is more complicated in the system we have now, rather than just saying, oh, okay, top choice, that's my favorite. This is the second favorite I have, third favorite, bam.
All right, so plenty of examples where we can understand how it might work. And Tim Nealand, as you observe what's going on in cities like San Francisco, Santa Fe, Minneapolis, now the state of Maine, and you look around the world, is there enough of a complaint rising in Americans' minds that we're going to be looking at real models, or is this just going to be the wonky playground in some quarters?
I think part of the problem is that most Americans are not aware that this could even be a potential, that they have been socialized into believing what you do is you go in, you pick one candidate, that one candidate gets a plurality of votes, which isn't a majority, just the most votes, and then you settle on that. You pick the lesser of two evils if you're concerned that the other political party is going to win a seat. And I think that is one of the things that a program like this will do is educate individuals out there that, hey, we have options. This has been tried in other places. It works. And so it's really going to have to come from the grassroots to make any sort of systemic change. So I think there's a potential here. I do think that it's more likely to happen locally or in a county rather than statewide because of the kind of opposition you saw in Maine where the politicians and elected officials did not like this.
Yeah, this is a case where, and I'm not picking on the current president, I'm just trying to kind of work through a recent primary in which the Republicans started off with, I think, 17 candidates in their early primaries. And of course, that dropped off pretty quickly. But let's say you're a Republican voter midway through the primaries and you had Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and who were the remaining? Boy, it's amazing how fast you forget who was on the ballot.
John Kasich.
Thank you, Jeb Bush, even Carly Fiorina. Let's say you had those half dozen. It's possible that Donald Trump supporters would have him number one, but it's possible that if you were not a Donald Trump supporter, he'd be last.
Right.
And it's possible that with that system, he would not have won, even if he got a plurality of first place votes. Is that correct, roughly?
Right, because it's a plurality. And so then you start going down the list and saying who had the fewest votes. We take those votes. We see who the second choice on that was. We divvy those up. Does anybody get to 50%? And we keep going down the line over the next several choices. Now, complexity is if, and they tried this, I think, in Minneapolis and they had like choices for everyone. Everyone was ranked. That gets complicated for voters. You don't have to rank them all. You could do one. But it's more likely you're going to get some spoiled ballots where people accidentally pick, more than one candidate for their second choice. So three choices is always good because people can handle three.
Okay. And so from what my reading of this is, and guests, please tell me before, Jesse looks like he's ready to jump in on the possible pitfalls of this, but before we get there, the biggest possible benefit seems to be, from what I'm reading, that you have fewer polarizing winners, that you have maybe the winner of an election isn't the candidate that sets the world on fire, but it is the candidate that the bulk of the voters, the electorate, will say, I can live with that. Is that correct, Seth? Do you think, let me ask you directly then, Seth, you've taught this. Do you think Donald Trump would have won the primary and won the election if ranked choice voting had existed back then, had been utilized?
I don't know, but it sure does raise some questions. He certainly took advantage of the system. I mean, he would nail one person a week, basically, it seemed to feel like. Okay, he's going to pick on Marco Rubio, and then Marco Rubio fades. Okay, he's going to pick on Ted Cruz. So if they all had the fair shot and you could rank preferences, it could have been different. And I was looking at presidential elections in 2000, 2016. Third-party candidates got a lot of votes. Got a lot of votes. Nader had 97,000 votes in Florida in 2000, and it was a 600-vote difference between Gore and Bush. In the 2016, I mean, Jill Stein in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, where Trump won all three states, Jill Stein got enough votes to make a difference in that gap, and Gary Johnson got significantly more. So it's definitely like an interesting conversation for third and fourth and other parties.
So what do you see, Jesse? Look like you had some thoughts, and I don't want to read too much, and as a concern about this, though.
Yeah, I want to be clear. I'm not advocating against it because we do, I think I do in general support it. But most of what I read about Maine was this idea that they were frustrated with electing governor after governor with under 50% of plurality, which also means the other way to look at it is they were trying to do something about the spoiler effect of what they actually put in the article called the Nader effect. Where they were splitting votes and electing someone who's not acceptable to a majority of people. you know, and we could do ten shows on how did Trump get elected, but you know, essentially it was the fact that there was 17 candidates in the race for so long. There was the caucus system in many states, and the fact that the press gave him billions of dollars of free advertising. I mean, I'd love to hear other people's opinion on that, but I think that's how I sum it up to people. You know, that's basically, he has CNN to thank for his presidency, essentially. So I'm not sure if instant runoff voting would have solved that problem, but I think what it's getting at is trying to stop the spoiler effect. And what I've read is the concerns. There's a couple of concerns that we could flesh out. There's a constitutional concern. It's not just Maine. It's the one person, one vote in the U.S. Constitution. That if I vote for the front runner, my vote, I get my one vote. But if you vote for two spoiler candidates, not who won't be spoiling in this race, you get three votes because they drop off, and then you get your third vote counts. And then the other concern is the spoiled ballots. The more complicated the ballots get, I was actually going to print one out and bring it, but then I realized we were on the radio, so it would be good for you guys. But our ballots, especially with fusion voting in New York State, are already pretty complicated. So you may end up with more ballots thrown out. And I've actually read some places that in the beginning, as voters are starting to get used to it, it actually diminishes turnout a little bit because they don't know, you know, they're not sure what to do, so they just opt out. You know, and I think, so I think there are some concerns that we should flush out. Not that I'm advocating against it, but.
Okay, and I've got some emails already coming in on the subject. I'll get to those in just a second. I do want to ask all of our guests about third parties. Seth mentioned third parties in some notable national elections. But Jesse Lenny, the Working Families Party, this is how I typically characterize a lot of. I've heard people on occasion say, "Well, doesn't WFP and Green Party share a lot of values, and do they have different strategies?" Usually, my answer after having talked to someone like you is that Working Families Parties tends to endorse and work within a Democratic sort of the duopoly of Republicans and Democrats, because you feel pragmatically you've got to move those Democrats, I guess, leftward or in the direction of the politics that you want, as opposed to saying we're going to try as a third party to shout into the wind, which feels kind of fruitless. I mean, I don't know if that's fair.
I mean, I think I would nuance a little bit. We don't really buy into the duopoly theory. And in fact, if you want to go that far, most districts in New York State are gerrymandered to the point where there's really only one party. So there's
fair.
Just one party in the city of Rochester. There's just one party in Riga. And most of the rural, most where most.
But you're not running WFP against Democrats typically.
In primaries, we do sometimes. We are right now for governor. I mean, there is no monopoly on primaries. So we oftentimes recruit and train progressive Democrats to run against more moderate conservative Democrats in primaries. And when we win, then we have to help our candidates win the general. And then oftentimes we have to help the Democrat that we are lucky enough to have run against the Republican in the general.
Okay.
Because they're better.
Do you think ranked choice voting is a chance for, and I know some people who work in non-Republican and non-Democratic circles don't like the term third party. That's fair. But do you think
that better than minor party.
What's that?
It's better than minor party.
What do you prefer,
other
by the
party.
Way?
The third party's fine with me.
Third party's fine with you? Okay. See, well, if Jesse says it's fine, then for the duration of the hour, it's fine. Do you think ranked choice voting increases the viability of third parties?
I think fusion is the answer to this problem in New York State.
What do you mean by fusion?
In that as a third party, you can participate in primaries, and then in the general, you can fuse your votes in with one of the major parties. I mean, fusion vote is actually one of the other methods. There's runoff voting, there's jungle ballots, jungle primaries. So I think with fusion voting, we have an opportunity to use that in New York State. It's it would be hard to imagine doing them both on the same ballot. But I mean, we certainly could, because you could do runoff voting, rank choice voting in the primaries, and then the general ballot could be the same. So I think part of the reason we haven't thought of that here is because we're really trying to push the limits of how to use fusion voting to get people's choice, you know, the most progressive choice, into the primaries, and then that's where we test our mettle against the more establishment candidates, and if we could beat them, then we go on to win the general.
Okay. Seth, do you think so-called third parties would be more viable with ranked choice voting?
Yes, but I'm sadly not going to go on that question. I'm kind of stuck on the... One of the main points I have is that I think instant runoff ranked choice voting would be a game changer, particularly in primaries. If I'm any of the four candidates from the Democratic primary for the New York 25, formerly Louis Slaughter position, I don't feel that great about the results. If I'm the winner, Joe Morelli, I only got 45% of the vote. So if we had ranked choice, how many of those people would have had me second? And at least by the end of it, I would have had a majority. If I'm any of the other three candidates, I'm wondering, did somebody pick Joe Morelli because they thought he would be a stronger candidate in the general election? They preferred me, but they picked Joe. Is somebody else a polarizing candidate? And did they not vote for me because they definitely didn't want that polarizing candidate? So similar to third party, where people might feel comfortable to vote for that third party because they know they can still have the Democratic Party second in their voting. It does, I think, support the opportunity for more people to vote for what they believe in, rather than try and figure out this complicated thing of who do I not want to win. So I guess long answer to your question, I strongly believe it would help third parties.
Okay, Tim Nealon.
I think the potential is there. I think, again, it would take a little time. If you look, again, the way socialization has happened and this idea, you call it a duality, I think a lot of people's, maybe their first choice would be a third party, but I imagine their second choice would be a major party because they would be voting against someone, you know, for example, a Working Families Party member is probably not going to have a Republican on their choices. So they don't want a Republican elected so that their choices would reflect that. I think it would actually, though, enhance the recruitment of candidates. If a candidate knew that they could get a substantive number of votes and not look ridiculous and spend all that time to get 5% of the vote, I think you could get some really interesting candidates that would shake the system up. I think if you got these interesting candidates, the tail effect of that is that you're going to get more people out to vote. Mm-hmm. They're going to say, this guy's really interesting, or this person is really interesting, or this female candidate's really interesting. And I like what they're saying. I'm not sure, you know, I'm afraid the opposition party is going to win, but I can cast my ballot for them. And they're going to then participate in the system. And once you start voting, it's like eating potato chips. You want to vote again and again and again. And so I think that's the thing. The other thing, you'll learn how to use this ranked choice system, which, again, it can be complicated. We're trying to simplify the ballot. On the other hand, democracy is not simple. And so maybe you have to take a little bit of training for the next generation of voters to work this in.
Yeah, I'm looking at The Economist, that recently had a piece on the possible benefits of ranked choice voting, and their first benefit listed was turnout. Reading from The Economist, ranked choice voting boosters say it changes campaigns and elections in several laudable ways, and at first encourages voter turnout. A study of 79 elections in 26 American cities found that ranked choice voting was associated with a 10% increase in turnout compared with non-ranked choice voting primary and runoff elections, and San Francisco's race had the highest primary turnout in years. Voters turned off by the frontrunners have less incentive to stay home. They can give their first choice vote to their favorite candidate, even if he or she might be a losing choice, while allocating their other choices strategically.
San Francisco is super interesting. I was just talking to a friend of a friend, and there were four in this past mayoral primary. There were four candidates for the Democratic Party, and two of them actually developed an alliance. So basically, I'm running, and I say, "Listen, I know you love me. I should win, but if you got to put down a second choice, put down Tim because he's awesome."
And I am number two.
He's number two. And so the two candidates, two of the four candidates, made an alliance, and so that's promoting this whole collaborative, positive nature, which is also good for parties, rather than spending most of your time talking about the negative aspects of your colleagues within your party.
All right. So on that point, and by the way, Dan and Brighton, I'm going to come to you first on the phones, but let me just sort of we've got to stick with this point to kind of close the loop on this, because this is an important point that advocates of ranked choice voting make. The point that Seth just made, let me read an email from a listener. And again, I'll go back first to The Economist. And this is what The Economist says about diffusing partisanship. Quote, ranked choice voting has long been a darling of political scientists, but Maine's experiment should interest anyone frustrated by America's cripplingly partisan politics. Ranked choice voting may be unable to force liberals and conservatives to like each other, but it could at least blunt the electoral effects of hyper-partisanship. And The Economist points to the recent Maine gubernatorial primary on the Democratic side, in which two of the candidates did an ad together saying, hi, I'm so-and-so, vote for her. And she said, hi, I'm so-and-so, vote for him. And they were laughing and shaking hands and smiling. And voters, you know, in some ways liked that, and they felt, you know, a little better about that. And here's Jane's email. Jane writes to us and says, Evan, I love ranked choice voting. With this approach, candidates focus on the things they agree on rather than firing accusations against each other. So if you're a candidate, you try to appeal to the other candidate's supporters by telling the voters how you are alike, not how you are better than the other candidates. It builds collaboration and a unified party message. Thanks for doing this important show. Jesse, you buying that? Do you think there's some value there in could ranked choice voting diffuse hyperpartisanship? And then as a follow-up, do we need to diffuse hyperpartisanship?
Yes, I think it can, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think we measure the value of elections as the policy we can get out of the people that win. So I mean, to the extent that the hyper-partisanship turns people off, that's not a good thing. The more people that participate, the better. And I definitely think what was mentioned earlier about encouraging people to run is the big thing. I mentioned in another show that I think getting quality candidates to run is how we increase turnout, regardless of how complicated it can be. So anything that makes it easier for people to run, I think, is the key. But I'm not sure how it'll affect. I mean, I'm actually thinking of the primary in 23, in New York 23, which I think reaches some of the listeners live in Ithaca and Dunkirk and Corning. You know, I think that sort of took a turn for the worse in that there was one front runner and four other candidates, and two or three of the other candidates felt their only strategy to win was to break down the first candidate, which, you know, wasn't helpful because we have the general election to do that. Right. And if they had instant runoff voting, maybe they could campaign for second place, or they could try to get at some of those other votes to stay in the game rather than doing that. So I think there was a couple opportunities. I mean, I think we need a little bit more time to evaluate how this is working in the other cities. I mean, that's what I noticed in doing a little bit of research this weekend, is there's not a lot of studies on it. And I also think we should try it out in some smaller markets. I mean, there isn't really a lot of small markets in New York State. Maybe some counties might work if the law allows that. But I definitely support it. I just think we should take a look at it for, you know, a longer period of time.
Tim Nealon, let me reference a conversation on this program last week about centrism, in which our guests sort of lampooned the idea that squishy centrism, this idea of always finding the middle position, is valuable. And our guests, you know, were kind of lampooning that, saying, look, that's sort of a false goal here, that we should be fighting for good policy if it comes from the right or the left or wherever, but good policy is good policy, not just the middle ground for the sake of the middle ground. And that one of the criticisms of ranked choice voting is it gives you the squishy center. It gives you this vanilla middle ground. You know, the winner is the choice that people, yeah, I'm not fired up by this candidate, but he or she is fine. You know, as opposed to somebody who's more of a firebrand willing to get things done.
I don't know. I think there are a lot of great society programs passed with Republican votes. And I think that there was a kind of cross-the-aisle discussions going on. When Southern Democrats would reject Lyndon Johnson, he knew he could go to the center, the moderates in the Republican Party, and he could work with the moderates in the Democratic Party to get good policy. So I'm sorry I missed that show, but I would actually not lampoon it. I think you actually can get really good policy when you listen to a variety of voices from the right, from the left, from the middle, and then from there, you get something that works. It doesn't work great. This is America. We're always fixing something. I mean, no public policy solves everything. It usually creates new problems. But it would at least move public policy, and it wouldn't be static or retrograde. And I think that actually could be something that comes out of something like this ranked choice voting.
Something like that. Yeah. And by the way, on the subject of centrism, that doesn't mean all centrism is bad. Our guests agreed that procedural centrism is good, which just means you're not just tribally political to your party. A good idea can be from the right, the left, or wherever. But it's not just a, hey, Tim wants to nuke 100 million people. I want to nuke zero people. Seth, as a moderate, says, let's just nuke 50 million people. And then we can agree that we found the middle position. No, the idea of procedural centrism is more what we're looking for. And the criticism of ranked choice voting is you get that vanilla please everybody sort of thing. But you don't seem to think that's a real risk here.
I don't think so, because I think the places where it's existed have generally been progressive places anyway. And so that policy is not going to be squishy or centrist. It's going to be sharp and it's going to be focused, but it's going to have the buy-in of over 50% of those people who cast ballots. And I think that will make it stronger in the public mind.
Okay. Seth, some thoughts on this?
I'm thinking a lot about something Jesse said, and I was thinking about this morning, that we need to do more research. We need to do more asking questions. And this is why I really appreciate your show. You often bring up important questions that our politicians aren't really talking about. And I would love to see instant runoff voting being some research in Monroe County or Rochester about it. And I think if you are a local activist who wants change, this is a type of thing, how we vote, that can create change with our current political system. And there's clearly some movement. I've been of local, and I've been following the guy in Hawaii who's running, I think, for a House position, young guy. But nobody's talking about this, and I think if we want change, we've got to be bringing up these questions that those in power don't really want to talk about. And instant runoff choice voting is not like a huge thing for the big Democratic or Republican parties. Should be, looking at some of the past presidential elections. So I'd love to see some local people asking more questions and research about this and bringing this up. And I've thought about that and something to talk about in my classes.
All right, I want to get to your phone calls. Dan in Brighton's going to start when we come back from our only break, and we got some more emails from listeners. I want to hear from Seth O'Brien about what his students think after learning about these options, which, again, probably is our first exposure to it. They're students at the Harley School, where Seth teaches math. He's also the director of the Commons there. Tim Nealon is the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Jesse Lenny, Western Region Political Director for the New York Working Families Party. Let's get that only break and come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, the narratives we often hear about millennials and this generation of workers might not be true. These narratives say that millennials are working in the gig economy, cobbling together incomes from multiple sources to make ends meet, or jumping from job to job out of necessity or desire to find something better. Well, the data say none of that's true. What does it mean? We'll explain next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We just lost Dan in Brighton. Dan, call us back because we want to hit your point for sure. Neftali in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Neftali.
Hi. I'm an economist, not the one that you're talking about, unless you're talking about an article in the periodical of The Economist. But, you know, there is really no perfect voting system, and that was proven by Kenneth Arrow, who in fact, won a Nobel Prize a number of years ago for work in this area, as well as some others. The problem with ranked choice voting as opposed to the system that we have today is that it's a more complex system, which means that it's more subject to manipulation. People can vote much more strategically in a ranked choice voting system than they can in a regular majority or plurality rules system. It depends to some extent on people having what we call single-peak preferences. That is, you're a liberal, so you would rank the most liberal guy first and the second most liberal guy second, and so forth down to the most conservative person who ran or who was running for office. But you might not be that sort of a person. You might be, for example, a multiple-peak person. We need change, so my first choice is Bernie Sanders, and my second choice is Donald Trump, because they're both off the beaten track in terms of the current political venue.
Sure.
And if you have something like that, you end up with what we call a recursive voting system, where you never really come up with a distinct outcome, or could. end up with such a system. So this is no panacea by any means, and involves a certain amount of additional expense, although it could be offset by not requiring runoffs under other circumstances. For those who are interested in pursuing this, public television many years ago under a set of programs called For All Practical Purposes has a three or four segments on voting in that set. It's available on DVD.
Okay.
It used to be on VHS. And it's suitable for classroom use, as a matter of fact.
But, Neftali, you know, it sounds like you think something like a system like this is, I mean, the primary concern I'm hearing is that it's sort of manipulatable and that it, manipulable. I don't know what the word is.
It actually will be manipulated. You can be sure of it.
Okay. All right. So thanks for the phone call. Jesse, Lenny, do you share that concern that this system will be manipulated?
They're definitely seeing that in California with the jungle primaries where parties are.
And again, definition of a so-called jungle primary.
Everybody from all different primaries runs in a massive primary. And so some of the political parties limit the amount of people they have in those primaries. The Republicans limit the number of people in those primaries so that they can focus their votes. They can sort of bullet vote. We definitely don't think that those are working right now in California. And there's several articles about there's some very strange effects. Your other parties, I mean, I think the other thing to think about, too, is that really it matters in what kind of context this is implemented. In a closed primary system in New York, this might be fine. But an open primary system, this would really create havoc. Where a closed primary, only members of the party, you have to pick a party that you're a member of, hopefully because you believe in something they believe in. But sometimes you just pick a party because you want to manipulate the primaries. And so in an open system, everybody can vote. So if one major party doesn't ever have primaries and the other one always does, you could see a situation where they come in and they rank choice the person they think is the worst candidate who will play the easiest to beat in the general. And so if this in a closed system, this might be okay, but in an open primary system, this could really be a problem.
Mm. Seth?
So when I teach this in class, the first thing I start off with is talking about what is the purpose, what's the goal of the voting system, and you need to, that's how you're going to decide which is the best. And so I don't think the simplest is the goal. The goal that I promote with my class is to pick the one that is the most fair. And I would think with what we're talking about, I would say the goals are the most fair and the most voter turnout. And then thirdly, even like Tim was talking about, getting the most candidates to be interested in doing this type of work. And I am definitely somebody who, in the current system, I'm just not going to get involved with running. But if there was something like ranked choice, where, like Tim said, is I could go out, the Democratic Party would never really be a fan of me, but I could go out and find some party that does support me and get some votes and just have a fresh start, that would be amazing. My students tend to fall in line with what's called Borda Count, which is one of the most
popular. B-O-R-D-A, by the way, is what Seth just said. Yep. The Borda Count. It's definitely worth researching. Yes.
And that's like with sports, that's the most commonly used method for sports awards. The big difference here is it's a point system. So if you are first place, you might get 10 votes. Second place, you might get, 8 points. And then third place, 6 points. That is a method I think that's a little bit too complicated for an election type system. However, that's the system that my students select the most. But now I've doubled the amount of knowledge I have about this topic in the last week. So now I have a lot of articles and a lot of real life stuff for my students to think about. And I was thinking about this cool project where we can have a debate about all the best systems, pick the best, and then send some letters to our local representatives, be like, what are you talking about voting methods? Because this is important. You know, who is our president? Who is our mayor? Who is our local House representative? That affects our lives every single day. So if something's slightly more complicated than something else, that's fine if it's going to get us what's best and what's most fair.
And then just briefly, Tim, before we get to Dan on the phone, I think every election system, someone is going to try to manipulate it.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are a lot of people who voted for Joe Morelli in a recent primary because they're strategically thinking this is the guy that will win in November. That's the same kind of strategy you were talking about. So everyone does that. I mean, voters are both very irrational. They take heuristic cues, and so it may not be based on party or liberalism, but what they like about the candidate. But they also can be strategic, where they think, okay, I'm voting for the person that's going to beat the opposition because I don't want them in power. So I think all systems are it comes down to the voter, really does, and that's great because that's democracy.
Let me get Dan in Brighton next on the phone. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead, Dan.
Unlike others, I think this country needs some centrist parties, and I think the only way to get them is to switch to a proportional legislature instead of district-based legislature. And since your guests seem to have backgrounds in political science, I won't explain to them, but if they don't know what I'm talking about, I will explain to them. And I've run into some political science majors who didn't know what I was talking about. So quickly, find out if they know what a proportional-based legislature is, like in the European countries, or if I have to explain it to them.
Proportional-based legislature.
Yeah, that would really be our dream, but I didn't think we could propose it.
Yeah,
you've got nods around the table. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Go ahead, what?
Do you want to say more about that?
No, do I need to explain it?
You don't have to explain it. Go ahead.
Okay, then I will just hang up and listen to their comment.
All right, thank you. So I will ask the political science professor for our listening audience who are less familiar with proportional representation. Go ahead, Tim.
Right, so right now we have single-member districts where you cast a ballot, you're selecting one person to the Assembly and one person to the Senate in these districts. In a proportional system, what you would do is you'd have several candidates running in a district that would be much larger, and that you would be able to cast more than one ballot, and they would divvy these up proportionally, so that, say, 30% went to the Working Families Party, 40% went to the Democrats, and 30% went to the Republicans. What they would do is they would divvy up whatever proportion of seats were available in that district based upon the number of ballots cast. So that would actually encourage more turnout, would encourage more diversity. It would get rid of some of this gerrymandering that we're talking about that has created these districts that are favorable to one party over the
other. Do we need it here?
Absolutely. There's no reason not to have it. Again, I'm not a partisan for any political party, so it would implode the political parties and they would be unhappy with it. But I think it would encourage voter turnout and candidates, and golly, who knows what kind of policy you get. You have to have strategic alliances in the legislature. It'd be
but
awesome.
Tim, the reason we don't have it is just what? Power protects power here and it doesn't want to change?
It'd make it impossible to gerrymander.
Yeah.
Exactly. So right now, power is protecting power, and they like being able to draw
the rules. Well, the parties in power are actually our governing body, and they create the election laws, which tend to protect their own power. And so they make it very difficult to get on the ballot to begin with, and then they make it difficult for anybody besides the two major parties to win an election.
And I'm afraid someone from Connecticut's listening, so I might get this wrong. But in Hartford, they have proportional representation. I think it's Hartford. School board or city council, they have proportional representation, and the Working Families Party actually supplanted the Republican Party as the second party in the city.
So you said this would be a dream of the WFP,
proportional representation? Yeah, because if you could get, instead of just, you know, right now we have working families Democrats who are much more like us, but you could have people run as Republicans, we could have that, and you could have working families candidates or Green Party candidates. It would also take away the incentive to the incentive for the Republican Party to sort of prop up spoiler candidates against Democrats.
All right, so in other words, it's worth reading up on if you don't know proportional representation, and it is just as likely as every elected lawmaker in this country giving up their full salary forever. So probably never. But
some cities have it. I mean, Philadelphia has it, for example.
National level? No way.
Yeah, no.
I don't think it's happening. The urge to protect the power to draw your own districts and to control some of those results is pretty strong. But, Dan, thank you for that. I'm looking at some of the complaints that came from David Lebedoff, who wrote for TwinCities.com in Minnesota, opposing ranked choice voting. And one of the – I mean, we've covered some of the ground. He says some people like to play games. Again, you just heard Tim Nealon talking about how there's going to be attempted manipulation in all forms of elections. The question simply is, which is the most fair? Lebedoff also said voting should be easy and that this is going to be confusing. Again, the results elsewhere indicate that this either keeps turnout the same or increases. It's not a case of people saying it's too complicated, I'm staying home. He says a great merit of real majority rule is that it confers legitimacy on whomever wins the election. In other words, the person who gets the most votes. But majority rule is not the same as plurality rule. So Seth, what would you say to someone like David Lebedoff who says, I don't care if there's five candidates running or 20 or two, that the person who gets the most votes ought to win that election, even if it's a plurality? What do you say to that?
I mean, look at some of those Republican primaries in 2016 or again, Joe Morelli. Like, would you rather have 45% of the vote and win or instant runoff and end up with 62% of the vote the second round?
And Seth, you don't have to look at Joe Morelli. I mean, that's 45%. In both major parties' presidential primaries, there are routinely early states in which the winner gets 27%, 26%.
I don't know if Trump got a majority anywhere in the primary.
I think he did later on.
Later on, as people started dropping out.
Yeah. So, but Lebedoff would say, fine. Whatever. Who cares? If 27% wins, 27% wins.
I mean, you're a journalist, so this is slightly mean, but it sounds like a journalist taking a stance to just try and have an interesting article with that argument of 34% winning is better than, you know, second, third round, fourth round, a candidate getting
56%. You think it's just a bad argument?
Yeah, I think it's just trying to get... Okay. You know, an argument.
Just to come to Evan's defense, I mean, I feel like if you count the people who don't vote, who basically are conceding consent to the people that do, they're surrendering, you know, it's their right not to vote, as we talked about in one of the last shows, but there isn't any candidates who aren't elected with a majority of eligible voters, if you look at – so, I mean, that's one thing. I think this is a little bit of a solution looking for a problem because I was surprised when I read about in the main press – that plurality was what pissed people, was making people so interested in this, because I feel like in a lot of these, especially in primaries, each candidate brings in a whole new group of voters. So we had, you know, in a lot of cases, we had a big turnout in this last primaries because there's five candidates and they all brought their bases with them. So I think one of the things I'd be interested in watching how this works is if, let's say, Robin Wilt or Adam McFadden decide not to run this last time or we're not on the ballot. There's a big group of people who just wouldn't have bothered to show up because they came to vote for them in particular, and now if they brought people, those candidates are bringing people to the polls, they cast their first vote, which they weren't going to win with, but their second votes now count, even though if the candidate wasn't in the race, they wouldn't have voted at all. So, and I think you start to worry about the constitutionality of it too.
So two things about Maine. There's a little more context to the change. The governor who won with that plurality in his Republican primary in 2010, I mean, I think LePage, he's an unbelievably polarizing, skip all the other adjectives, governor. And the reason for the referendum was they were uncomfortable that this guy won when he's so polarizing and less than a majority of us believe in what he's doing for our state. The other thing I wanted to say that's fascinating is in this election, this primary, there was the governor race for the primaries, and 200,000 people in Maine voted in the primaries for the governor race. 250,000 people voted one way or another on the referendum. So 50,000 people in Maine came out to vote just to vote on the referendum. So that, to me, says something. And the referendum won by about 30,000, 40,000 votes.
Let me read some more feedback from listeners coming in fast and furious this hour. Ray Ray in Rochester says, open primaries are not the issue. You are not progressive if you limit the ability of people to vote in an election, especially New York closed primaries that are run using public money. If you want to exclude voters, then pay for your own primary. Ranked choice, top two runoff, open primaries, cultivate quality candidates in the spring to be diversely harvested in the fall. Mm-hmm. Stop centering fear around our electoral process. Alan writes and says, here's his experience with ranked choice voting. At work, he says, my institution publishes a booklet listing open positions with short resumes. I rank the candidates for positions by reviewing the resumes. This forces me to decide which strengths and properties are most important to me. More complex, maybe, but not a bad thing. That's from Alan in Pittsford. And I want to read an email from Nancy, who says, wants to talk about approval voting. She says, when my husband and I raised our three kids and wanted to make a choice about where to eat out, we would present to them a list of about four possible restaurants. Then we would ask the kids to think about which one or more restaurants they would be okay eating at. A clear consensus winner almost always emerged. Interestingly, I was teaching at the time at a respected liberal arts college in Pennsylvania. At one faculty meeting, the math department presented a proposal to change the method used for faculty election to what they called approval voting. On a list of candidates, faculty checked all candidates whom they would approve for the particular office. Their statistical analysis showed the advantages of such a system. The faculty voted to make the change in voting systems. After adopting the new voting system, the faculty, who tend to be a contentious bunch, found the method to produce far more contentment with the results than under the standard vote-for-only-one system. So how does approval voting compare to ranked choice voting? That's from Nancy in Geneseo. Sounds very similar, though I guess everyone would have to be marked approved. I mean, I don't know much more beyond what she described. Seth, do you?
I mean, that's one of the methods we teach. I didn't read a million articles about it before I came here, okay. But there's four of us in this room, and you could go and give as many. It's just a yes or no, basically. And if one of us was going to be the president of this room, you could vote yes, you like all four of us, yes, you like one of us, you like two of us, whatever. It's got its advantages and challenges. My big thing and why I appreciate this show is I do think, in contrast to Ray Ray, we should be asking ourselves, do we have the best voting system right now, and do some research and have a conversation about it.
All right. Let me also, before the hour is up here, get a comment from Andrew, who writes to us and says, Evan, I've been sold on this idea for a while. My question for the panel is what it's going to take to actually make it happen. Are there any national organizations being strategic about how to get the legislation passed for ranked choice voting? What are the barriers? Who would be against it? Jesse Lenny?
Well, the states are the sort of the laboratory of democracy in this. And I would go even further to say the cities are. I mean, I think if you want to advocate for this, the best way to do it would be like the way we advocate for minimum wage and a lot of other progressive policies is try to win it, try to figure out how to win it in a city and then how to win it in a smaller state. You know, I mean, I was actually thinking we should go back another year and look at the city council primary in Rochester where there was 17 people running for five spots. And frankly, the five we endorse were the best because we're the best. But there was 8, 9, 10 at least that were really great candidates that we all hoped would run again for something else. So it would have been interesting to see how this worked in a big field like that. So, I mean, I think if you're with this, you should try to advocate for it.
Okay.
And see what the law is that would allow it in the city.
Right. I think you'd have to change the law. You definitely would have to make sure if you're using electronic voting machines that it passes muster nationally and statewide, because there are now codes indicating what kind of some districts have done hand counting, which is incredibly difficult and challenging. So you'd have to get that. There is the ranked choice voting organization, which is promoting this, and they're in alliance with Fair Vote right now, and they've got some money, and they've been advocating this for decades, and so there is a sustained way they go through. How do you get this? How do you develop it? What do you do? There's a kit that you can get from them that will help you try to deploy that. And I think Jesse's right. You need to do it. Start in the city of Rochester. It's very progressive. It'd be a great place to try this out. Maybe move out to the countywide. That would be very interesting. I know that our election commissioners are just awesome, and they could no doubt help us overcome any difficulties and challenges with the state ledge. And so, yeah, but that's what you'd have to do. And you just got to get the elected officials to agree. But, you know, some of those people have been, you know, trying to get on the ballot for years themselves. Maybe they'd be in favor of this.
Okay. Seth, any ideas there for Andrew?
I agree with Tim. I've been reading a lot on the Fair Choice or Fair Vote or whatever it's called website. They're all over the country working in every state. But, yeah, I mean, change is hard. I've been following Great Schools for All for a long time now and with reviewing school borders and change is hard.
Change is hard. And lastly, let's close with this. Lebedev's last complaint in Minnesota was that the new rules may themselves determine the outcome of the election. And he writes, the most serious flaw of ranked choice voting is that rules should assure that the voters get who they want, not who the rule writers want. I don't know what he means by that other than to say he thinks the rule writers are going to try to game this system. I don't see that in ranked choice. Is there any reason to think that this will be gaming?
If your goal is to get the most acceptable, the most palatable candidate, then writing this it seems like that's the goal of the rule writers, if they were to write.
Fair enough. So,
we didn't have an assembly to figure out if that was the goal. Like, that might not be the goal. The goal might be if you're a partisan and you want to advance, you know, guaranteed income or guaranteed jobs or guaranteed education, you might not want the most palatable person.
Okay, but that's a good place to close it, because I said earlier, you know, there's this idea that it would be a centrist who ends up winning, someone who's mildly acceptable to quote-unquote both sides. You don't seem fully convinced that would be the case with the ranked choice.
The thing that I was watching in practice, I think it's hard to assume that that's going to be the case. I mean, I feel like we also may have the opposite effect where people feel right now there is a lot of tribalism and people do not want the other side to win, so they vote for the candidate who they think will be most successful in the general. A lot of what primary voters think about is a strategy on behalf of their club. That's why we don't have open primaries, because you got to be a member of the club to vote for the president of the club. So with this, if this rule made them feel comfortable to vote for anybody no matter how wacky they were, we might end up getting more wacky candidates because people like wacky candidates.
You just used wacky as a non-pejorative.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no problem with wacky people. I'm not sure we don't want wacky candidates.
That's a first on this program. Jesse Lenny, who is not saying the WFP is wacky, but I take the point. What he's saying is maybe non-conventional, less safe, more daring, and maybe more interesting. We'll see. Jesse Lenny is the Western Region Political Director for the New York Working Families Party. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming back on the program. Seth O'Brien, wish I was taking your class as a math teacher at the Harley School. I know you'll have a lot to talk about with your students this fall. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Tim Nealon, Chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Always good, Tim. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
More Connections coming up.